Hey A1 fans, Andy here. We're going to Cisco Live and we can't wait to see you there. If we see you wearing an A1 or Cables to Cloud shirt at Cisco Live, we'll enter you in our giveaway that includes a bunch of cool prizes like an A1 branded Yeti cup and an OCG of your choice from our friends at Cisco Press. Don't have a shirt? No problem. Head to the link in our bio and grab yours today. See you soon.
This is the Art of Network Engineering podcast. In this podcast, we'll explore tools, technologies, and talented people. We aim to bring you information to expand your skill sets and toolbox and share the stories of fellow network engineers.
Welcome to the Art of Network Engineering podcast. This is Andy Laptev, and at the end of last week's episode, Barcastle was telling us about the type of workloads that are great candidates to build in the cloud. This week, we pick up the conversation with Bart explaining why software development is such a great candidate for cloud deployment. Here we go.
Here's a question too, because you mentioned it a couple of times, and I'm very good at this, speaking for both Andy and I, but I know from recent struggles, Andy's definitely in the same page as I am when it comes to software development. Okay, so like this is something that him and I have very, very little experience with.
Did you see me twitch when he said software development?
Yeah, well, especially from your college experience, Andy, like, you know, it's like C++ and I'm out. So what is it about software development that caters itself to cloud so well? Because, and maybe you should just back up, because software development is completely like just not in my realm of, I have any idea what that is, right? Like I get it. You could write like code and stuff, but like, can't I just write like code and stuff on my computer? Like, you know what I mean? I guess I don't get it.
Sure. Okay.
Can I say something real quick? I can tell
Andy,
that.
Jump in, please.
We have our own dev environment that we need to maintain.
So what is that?
It's a make pretend data center that the software guys test stuff in before they push it out to prod. And sorry, I didn't mean to step on you, Bart, but I know we're building a dev environment in the cloud. So it seems like, and I could be wrong, but I'm just throwing this out there. So eventually maybe we won't have to manage and maintain and replace EOL gear every time it goes. In my mind, and I don't know, but I figure we're getting rid of that on-prem dev environment and it's just going to be in cloud. And then, because for me, as a guy who manages data center stuff, I would love to like not have to replace the gear every 5 years and not have to worry about the code. And like, I love pushing that to the cloud. I think that's one of the, besides agility and spinning up things quickly, just giving it to them. Like, you know, now it's your problem. You know, now as a network guy, I got to be careful, because if I don't have routers and switches to maintain, what am I going to do? So I got to learn, you know, cloud and programmability. But sorry, I didn't mean to step on your dev. But that's my limited understanding of what dev is, where it lives, and why a company, you know, may be moving to the cloud, because it's one more physical environment they may not have to manage eventually. You know, just somebody else's problem, right?
Totally.
Yeah. Maybe.
Well, I'm curious, how much are you guys familiar with like a virtualization stack? I know that this has touched the networking world heavily because a lot of tools are virtualized now, but have we run hypervisors? Have we run storage area networks? We've been through some of that.
Yeah, so I'm familiar with that whole concept of virtualization, hypervisors, even containerization, all that kind of stuff.
Okay, servers, I guess, in our home labs, right? We got some VMs spun up on it for that kind of stuff.
And I guess maybe, you know, maybe that's where I'm going wrong, right? Because I'm thinking about it from like my perspective. So I guess I'm a networking dude. I don't know. You know what I mean? Like, what are we? I don't know.
I identify myself as a networking dude. Even now as a cloud person, I still say, you guys are my peeps. This is where I came from. It's what got me into where I am, is networking.
Yeah. So then you'll understand a little bit more than most folks would in that regard, because when I think about virtualization and stuff like that, so I'm basically thinking of only a couple of different things. Number one, running like some sort of like storage, right? Like you mentioned, like SAN or whatever. And that's usually the first thing that pops into my head. I'm like, oh, you're trying to store stuff or information needs to be sitting somewhere like constantly and people are grabbing it, that type of thing. Or me like virtualize like a VNF, like virtualizing a network function, right? Like those are the those are the two main things that pop in my head. So when you say stuff like, oh, this is a dev environment, like, you know how many times I've seen somebody type that or say that or I've heard it and I've just, for some strange reason, I've never even like Googled it. I was just like, whatever, dude, not my language. You know, I you know what I mean? Like to this day, I have no idea what a dev environment, I don't know what a dev is. I'm guessing it means development. Okay. Well, that still doesn't help me out any because, you know, obviously I'm underdeveloped in my brain here at this point. So I like, help me out here. So you're a, you go to the software software development companies. I understand that they're all writing code and stuff like that, but yeah, that's all they're doing. And like, I'm like Mansoor, where I'm like, oh, this guy's in the Matrix. Like, I have no clue what he's doing, you know? So what is it? What are they doing?
Yeah, okay.
What are they doing?
Well, for networking friends, I remember learning, like getting into networking early on in the career. And there was invariably a scenario where you're like, I need to see this in action. I need to bring these ports online. I need to configure these settings. I need to get this trunk working. Sure. And so you go and you buy yourself some gray market gear, you get it installed at home and you start playing with it. Well, in order for you to learn and grow your own skills, you had to have an environment that was safe for you to work and experiment in. For all intents and purposes, that's what a dev environment is to these software engineers. They need a room, a space in which they can test parts of the code, experiment with different integrations, try out different interfacing options, play with data structures, work with different databases, and use it as close as possible to what a production environment might look like. Sadly, okay, let me start with this way. Ideally, if a software developer could have it, they would have an exact copy of the production environment. That would be ideal. But we all know that that's unrealistically expensive and complex or just not available because we don't have any way to actually copy all of those pieces in some way for you to go and use them.
Oh, yeah, without manually redoing everything. Sure.
Yeah. So a dev environment simply is a place where you're able to go and experiment in as near to real or near to your envisioned running environment as you can possibly get. And there are often a whole bunch of caveats that come with it. And that's where, for me, when I first worked for my IVR company and I first really started touching software development, I wasn't a developer. I did a little bit of coding in college, but then actually getting to work with my developers and learning about source control and learning about their testing platforms that they use and how they actually go through in quality control and assure that what they're creating does what they say it does and will work in the environments that they say it'll work in, I did not appreciate the complexities of managing a development environment. These guys will go in there and girls will go in there and they will break the shit out of a system. And they're like, we broke it. It's broke. And I'm like, dude, I just gave you that before lunch. And so there I am like, okay, let me get out Clonezilla. Let me re-image the server for you. And in 4 hours, you got your test bed back. And they come back to me the next day and the thing is trash. And they're like, broke, we installed seven versions of Postgres and it doesn't work anymore. It won't start. So the first time that we had a chance to build images and use snapshots and restore virtual machines back to a previous point in time, it not only blew our minds from a possibility of functionality perspective, but it changed their actual day-to-day timelines. Instead of them waiting for me for a 24-hour cycle to return a new test system for them, they burn it down themselves. They pull out the most recent Gold Master that I built for them, and they run a new copy of the thing, and they're back online in minutes. That sort of power is what, that's why I work with software development teams as much as I can, because they are directly affected by some of the really big wins of virtualization, and those functionality is available in a cloud computing environment in a much bigger way. And this conversation gets into infrastructure as code really quickly.
Is that? Yeah, right. Hold on, man. Baby steps. You're halfway through the phrase infrastructure as a, and I'm like, as a service, and you're like, as a code. I'm like, now, yo, wait a sec. First of all, let's keep in mind, I have no idea what's going on. So the dev thing actually sort of makes sense now. So basically it's like, hey, I'm building an application. I'm clearly building it to do something.
And live in an environment. That's
and key. Live in an environment. Okay, yeah. Right. So it has to have a platform to sit on, clearly, because whoever's the end user of ultimate end user of my of whatever it is I'm developing, I want to emulate the environment in which they would be doing that. So this makes a lot more sense. So I'd be setting up and tearing down different things that I could be testing my software against.
Could be a web server, a database, an application component over here, a mocked up domain controller that your environment uses, things like that.
Okay. Because I'm kind of with you with the replication, not the replication thing, but like the golden config scenario where I remember Norton Ghost, right?
Sure, like, binary disk level imaging is
right. Yeah,
that was the trick for a long time.
It was the trick. Yeah, like hey, I need to get all these machines. So like, I used to go to this game. I'm throw some more LAN in there for you. my first exposure to this was like I played video games very early on too, and I was sponsored by a gaming center, and we had a room in the back where we could bring our own computers in, but it's a LAN center, so there was 30 computers in there, and like every 3 days or so. The dude would go around, and he's actually like one of my best friends. I call him the dude, but he's still one of my best friends. The dude. He would go around, and he would ghost all the machines. I think he was so forward at that point that he was even ghosting them over the LAN, which is crazy.
Sure.
When I think about it now, I mean, this was like 2000, right? And
yeah, PXP so was a thing for sure.
Yeah. So he was imaging these machines. So this is kind of what it lends it to, I think. And this is why it's going to make sense to me, is because the reason why he had to do that is because when kids come in and they play on, like you were saying, like EverQuest, we had a group of guys that would always come in and play EverQuest till like 3 a.m. That's being generous. It was typically like 6 or 7 a.m. or just days on end. And
they're not here. You can throw them under the bus.
Yeah, no, it's cool. That's the game is designed to make you do that anyway. Right. So these guys would be playing like 24 hours a day and stuff. And then they'd leave. And it's like, well, now I have kids coming in playing a different game and da, da, da. And then the problem is all of their settings were saved. Right.
Sure.
And so it's like if you changed your resolution or the DPI on your mouse or, you know, just simple stuff like even the controls. Yeah. Right. Like it's not a Nintendo. Right. A computer, especially at that time, wasn't anywhere built to be a gaming rig. Right. Like this is why Xbox got so successful, is because of that exact thing. It's like,
yeah, it's turnkey.
Yeah, it's turnkey. It gets you online, does all these things for you, right? Xbox Live has all these things built into it. But I guess my point is this, you know, the kids were basically like the devs in this scenario where, you know, a group of kids would come in and they would change a bunch of stuff. And then another group of kids would change a bunch of stuff. And then, you know, that's that third group. They'd come in, they'd be like, how did someone even change this? How do I get it back to zero here? And then, you know, enter Norton Ghost, right? Back to zero. Here we are. But but what a P in the A, because like you said, like putting the Norton Ghost in there and doing that, that was not an easy thing and is time consuming.
Super manual.
Super manual. But this makes a lot more sense to me now. So the whole dev thing with being able to go in and I guess kind of the idea is too that from a dev standpoint, you're almost like supposed to be breaking things in a sense, right? In most cases. Yeah. So it's like, hey, let's try to break it. Like what will happen if I do this? Like, and I'm just picturing Windows applications for some reason.
I mean, it's a lab, right? You want to make sure that you don't push something and take down all your clients.
We called it lab. We didn't really call it dev and prod for our team. We were a software development company. So our output was the software that we created. So the lab represented like 70% of our infrastructure.
Right.
Other things too, parallelism. I would have three different lead developers working on the same project that need the same environment.
Right.
And they can't step on each other's feet. So what am I going to do? Buy three of everything? We did a bit of that for a while.
I'm sure.
But the point is to think about the capacity problem that represents. And that is a perfect use case for why cloud computing services are such a great fit for shops like that, because they have a real capacity problem. And they also have some key functionality that they need that cloud services offer in a big way.
Hmm. No, I mean, that makes more sense, because to me, when I go in, especially, I'll just use AWS because that's the one I have an account on. So it's really the only experience I have for the most part. when I go in there and like the first drop down menu you see is I saw like E3 or S3, sorry, E3. Talking about video games.
EC3, so, S7.
Yeah. So nice. So I go to
S3. I'm trolling you. I'm sorry, man. Go ahead.
No, it's all good. So I said S3. I see the Lambda thing. And so what are those? Those are just then like, because you said a term earlier and I forgot what it was, but I tried Lambda. To catch it. But
Was it Lambda?
It was Lambda. He did mention Lambda, but but it was something specific to like what those are, like the software layer.
Managed services.
Okay.
Yeah.
So they're managed services. So basically, is Lambda then like the supposedly the dev environment, or how does that, what are they? Why is there so many of them? There's like 100 of them, right?
Oh, sure. Okay. So I guess just to step back here, Lambda itself is basically a container solution. So you can bring pieces of software and have Amazon run it for you without having to manage all the infrastructure underneath it. It's just a few steps away from a virtual machine. Okay. The difference is that you're not thinking operating systems. You're not logging into them and managing software that runs on them. Instead, you're like giving them this piece of discrete code, like a zip file, or pointing it to a source code repository somewhere where the content lives. And Lambda then can run the code for you. And it basically takes input, give me some data, and then it provides some output. And that is in its simplest form what every application does. And so when we think of what apps do, and you get into software development, you start thinking about functions and methods inside of a piece of code. The goal is to find reproducible and reusable components and get it to do this thing. This thing crunches these 5 numbers and produces this piece of output every time. You can throw lots of different kinds of numbers at it, but it always performs the same functionality.
Sure.
This is the same thing that you would do if you were building cars. You would figure out which part you could reproduce and repeat the process, and you would specialize a tool to help with that. Cloud vendors do that exact thing, and Lambda is an example of a service that does exactly that. It does not put the wheels on your car. It only focuses on installing a really kick-ass radio for you. That's its one sole purpose, is just to do this part of the application world. And then the rest of it is figuring out how you want to interface with it. Multiply that times 10 or 15 different types of functionality running as Lambdas, and now you have a microservices application. And each one of those layers can grow and run in parallel. And your application, if designed properly, it can go to this web scale target that they talk about, which is basically an unforeseeable amount of potential growth. And that's where some of that cloud fit comes in. If you're not an organization that's worried about web scale growth of your application, then Lambda is not going to be a very appealing thing to talk about with you. But if you're a software development team who is breaking functionality out and you want to build something that can handle TikTok, YouTube, Twitter level style traffic and parallel interactions, these are the patterns that you have to encourage, and these are the types of systems you have to have in the background. You are not managing operating systems. It isn't even a Linux and Windows conversation at this point anymore. You are compartmentalizing parts of what the apps do so that they can be specialized the same way that Henry Ford specializes in assembly line. It's all of those same principles at work here.
Wow.
I guess the last thing then was to kind of go back to your list about the menus.
AWS, there's like 100 of them.
So AWS has got a bunch of really big products that are kind of cloud native. Mm-hmm. They also have a lot of like off the shelf tools that are just managed. They have a managed Active Directory product. They have a managed Kubernetes project process that's available for running those containers. They have a managed Docker service. They have a managed search service, a managed analytics and query and data warehouse service. So depending on what you're using, they usually have an option that you can have a lot of control or a little control. And that's the sweet spot. It's a buffet where you can pick which part of it fits your purchase model and which part fits your skill set. And so that's what's really exciting for me as a solutions architect. I'm helping guide teams to make the right selections when they come to that very healthy buffet.
Wow. So clearly, okay. So correct me if I'm wrong here. What it sounds like is... most organizations, I know that's a scary thing to say because it's very general, but most
we get some organizations in here, bring them in here. Come on now.
Yeah. Hey, he's talking smack about you.
We're gonna grill again.
Okay. Hey, you idiots that were shaking your shoulders in the meeting room earlier. Get your butts back in here. So it sounds to me, correct me if I'm wrong, please, and school me once again, like you've done 100 times already. It sounds like that not a lot of people can realize the true potential or even see a good ROI on moving to the cloud just based surely off of what they have, like as far as a production goes, right? Like a ma and pa place, a even like a normal size software development company, like a smaller one. That's yep. different, I think, because of all the things you've outlined, because they
are unique. Tear down
things. Yeah, sure.
Yeah, yeah.
But okay, so like a local bank, like, you know, like to Andy's point, probably not, right? Like, what is it you guys are doing that you need to go to the cloud for? Is it fair to say that like that not as many organizations need the cloud as you may think, just on the surface level, because we see the word cloud everywhere and it's like, oh, you guys got to move to the cloud. Have you moved to the cloud yet? You know,
or is it tied to the size of the company, right? Like, is it more for mid to right. large places? Right.
I would say that the reason NIST even defined three different service models, infrastructure, platform, and software, was not because it's about saying you should use this model because of your style company. It's about identifying that managed services offer you different value augmentations. If you have a staffing problem, that's a different way of augmenting it than if you are missing a piece of functionality in your application. You can solve things in different ways. Getting to work in a car isn't going to be solved by going to college and getting a degree. You still need to figure out how to get to work. So we see a lot of organizations that are chasing a solution that they don't understand and then selecting what they perceive as solutions from a catalog that was not designed to solve those problems. So this is why I say, if it's not software as a service, you really need to go back and say, whoa, 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 what are we doing and why are we doing it? And what are the timelines and the risk and value elements behind it? One of the final things to kind of keep in mind is that it's probably the biggest disservice is to keep saying, let's go to the cloud. We're going to the cloud. Get in, you crazies. Everybody's going to the cloud. Because
to explain. We're going to the cloud.
But our competitors are going there, Bart. We have to.
Well, I'm just saying that the first thing I try to do is get them to stop normalizing the cloud as this giant nebulous thing that is like, I don't know. It's like a destination. And that's not really what we're thinking about. We're saying, okay, yeah. You want to go on vacation. I'm with you. Let's do it. But let's figure out where you would really like to go and what's going to help you get there. And so that's why software as a service emphasizes broad appeal for commodity services. So this means that the likelihood of getting a good return on software as a service is fundamentally higher, even if you just stumble blindly into it in the dark. Odds are you're going to be better at succeeding with a SaaS product than you are trying to move all your infrastructure over to a cloud service provider because of just the fundamental ways that value works in the managed services model. So that's usually the first thing I try to get people thinking about is like, let's not just call it cloud in general. Let's look at which parts of your company are most important, which ones have the best likelihood of being a good fit for cloud usage, and start there. And then look at the entropy that you start building, look at some of the inertia that comes from that, make some wins, gain some confidence, maybe improve your ROI. And before you know it, we can start having a conversation about some of these more difficult transitions that you might be trying to make.
Dude, yeah, you're less cloud Bart and you're more like cloud dad. Right, because
come on
like,
in here, guys.
Come yeah, because you're like, it's so funny because like I just feel like, especially from a consultancy standpoint, like, you know, the feeling is that like, oh, this guy just wants to make his money, right? But you have this air about it where you're like, hey, hold on, like let's talk about this first, and like you're almost like disappointed. You know, when someone is like thinking about doing something, as opposed to being like, no, we can move you there. You know, I mean, I'll take all your money, whatever.
It's probably a confidence that comes with all your experience, right? I mean, you know what you're talking about. You've seen it and you can probably see these problems coming. You know where they are before they know where they are, which would make, I think, you very valuable. I want to, before we run out of time, I don't know how long we're going, but I pulled...
Oh, we got plenty of time still, don't worry.
Yeah, I pulled our Discord server earlier today and said, if we were to talk to a cloud expert, what would you...
Oh, snap. You know, want you ready, for this?
Well, there's only a couple, but the first one I really like because it's relevant to what I deal with. So Tim Mack wanted to know about multi-cloud. What is it? Right. You see what just happened to his eye. So, you know, what is it? Why would you use it? you know, how and why. So, you know, what do you have to say about multi-cloud?
Okay, sure. So I think multi-cloud is basically, it's kind of the pinnacle of people being concerned about putting their eggs in one basket. They've been burned in the past by some software vendor. Every company will be able to stir up a story in which, depending on this one vendor, this one time, or this one service provider, this one time, bit them. We've all seen it, whether that be an internet outage, the loss of a critical piece of hardware, a failure in a contractual agreement or a service level not holding up muster. We've all been bitten by it. If you haven't yet, just wait.
So you're just dual homing to another cloud provider, right? Because the one's going to burn you, you know, in an oversimplified way.
Yeah, that is the root of why we look at multi-cloud. The truth is, though, that there's very few niches in which organizations would really truly benefit from multi-cloud, especially given that organizations that could benefit from multi-cloud probably already own extensive data centers that they could be leveraging and continue to leverage anyways. So when I hear organizations that are maybe the right fit, they probably ought to just consider the hybrid model and making sure that that works appropriately for them as opposed to multi-cloud.
Is that cloud and on-prem? Is that what hybrid is?
That's the shorthand of it. Essentially, it means you're using a combination of deployment models. And that could include public cloud, private cloud that you might be running in-house or using through other managed data center providers or leveraging community sorts of cloud environments. But again, they're pulling from the best fit for each particular scenario that you're in. Hmm. NIST tells us right early on that they predict hybrid will be the most common model. Hybrid technically fits the category of multi-cloud. You're still using a combination of systems and services.
Right.
But you would have to ask yourself very carefully, what's the benefit of actually running things consistently across two different vendors? Is that what we're looking at? Is it a failover scenario where this is dark and this is on?
Right. Are you running different workloads in each provider? Like, you wouldn't run the same.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. Right. For replications. Yeah.
Probably
Go ahead.
No, you're good. Probably the best reason why I would say anybody does multi-cloud is usually because of data center location. A great example of this, I've got a lot of peers in South Africa that I've worked with over the years. And South Africa has got a crazy amount of business down there. And only within the last few years even had real high-speed international access to internet through a variety of vendors. So the idea that you could run data centers, operate services down there, and you're talking manufacturing, mining, industry complex, you're talking about major financial institutions. It's a hotbed of business.
I mean, it's a whole country's worth of stuff. I mean, you know what I mean? You name it, right? Like, how do they survive without that?
And they just straight up did not have cloud service providers down there. And it's one of the longest round trip times on the planet. Going from there to other parts of the world, it's a crazy round trip time. So forget your latency expectations, my friends.
Yeah, right. Totally.
If that's a requirement, then you were really just SOL for a long time in parts of the world like that. Mm-hmm. So fast forward to now, where we have AWS, who's got 30 plus regions, and Azure has got a complementary number of regions as well. They're not all in the same places. Mm-hmm. So running multi-cloud is possibly only most entertaining because of the location options that it might offer you.
If your software has latency requirements and you'd have to be closer to your users, as an example.
Or things like GDPR, things that require certain proximities and locations. Most vendors can handle whatever those requirements are, but there are always going to be edge cases where you might need to have a data center in a certain location, and some providers are there and others are not. Now, those margins are closing fast because the big providers are moving, and AWS and Azure are both in South Africa now, and the big ISPs have moved lots of really big pipes down there as well. So things have changed, but that was where we were for a while there. And a lot of organizations still very much are concerned about their dependency on any one particular provider. And it's probably worth their while to consider the implications. But I've also not seen a whole lot of multi-cloud solutions that go well. And it is definitely considered a unicorn that you want to chop the head off of as a consultant in most scenarios. Because it's just, it's wildly complex. And you can do it, but you probably shouldn't do it in many scenarios. So that's one of those sorts of things where, it's easy to access and consider doing that. But really proving it out and demonstrating why that's valuable to you, it's difficult. And the other thing, like Andy was talking about earlier, you talk about end-of-life products. the way that a vendor continues to grow and develop their own internal expertise is really impressive. I mean, Microsoft has made amazing changes in the way that they deal with things like Linux. And the idea that you can now, one of my favorite statistics is that Azure runs more Linux workloads than they do Windows workloads. And I love
sure,
that.
Sure.
That is an incredible indication of where our industry is right now. Huh, and, yeah. You know, kudos to Microsoft for realizing that they shouldn't be competing with it. They should be finding ways embracing to augment it. And add yeah. value. Yeah, that's really where they will continue to excel at it.
God, but yeah.
To their defense, they were a software company for a long time. So running That's infrastructure fair. wasn't really their game.
True.
And it's probably one of the reasons why AWS beat them in such a big way, becoming the Gartner top leader for ever since they created the infrastructure as a platform category of Gartner services. So they've been up there as an innovator and the ability to execute against it for so long. In the end, it's one of the reasons why sticking with a vendor and encouraging them to grow their services in a way that will help you might be the better alternative to multi-cloud. Simply because, frankly, that's where a lot of the services came from. AWS is incredibly feedback-centric. They look at what their customers need, where they need it, and they develop their services in that way. So it's kind of a win-win for a lot of companies if you can get the timelines to work right for you. You might not be able to, you know, do it right this minute. But yeah, so to get back to the multi-cloud question, they're talking about multiple cloud vendors. Probably one of the other big problems behind it is that the most immovable mass of gravity in any enterprise is their data. So if you put petabytes and exabytes of data in one cloud vendor, it'll be hard pressed to demonstrate the value of trying to replicate all of that data to another vendor and not still have the dependency on where it lives and keeping your applications and all of the gravity mass of the world of data services around those critical pieces of data. That's almost always the most immovable part of it, the data.
Interesting.
Yeah, that you mentioned private cloud, and I still don't understand. Do you have a simple explanation? I mean, it's your data center, right, that you somehow create a private. I don't get it.
Okay, so NIST defines private cloud as something with a degree, the most extreme degree of exclusivity. They don't say anywhere in it that it has to be in your data center. It simply means that when it comes down to levels of control across the functional stacks that applications live in, you have the maximum level of control in a private cloud. It could be a hosted provider like Rackspace or somebody like your ISP who gives you data center space to run it in. But in the end, it still needs to fit the five traits of a cloud service. It needs to be network accessible. It needs to have self-service catalogs. It needs to have shared resources. It needs to have metered usage. So you're talking about granular, kind of flexible pricing models
behind
it.
Pay as you go. Yeah.
Yeah. It needs to offer options like that as well. Did I miss one? Did I say Elastic? I think it was the last one on there that
it can scale
and shrink. So you can run a VMware-based cloud or an HP-based cloud or an IBM-based cloud in your data centers, and it will do a lot of those things. But at the end of the day, some division of your organization still owns all those assets, and you're right back in the end-of-life game where you are replacing things and managing it. And maybe you're really good at it. Maybe you really suck at it. But that's kind of the problem with thinking private cloud and imagining the big public providers and thinking, can we bring all of that in? The final thing I would kind of mention here is that there has been a real big focus around this topic. Organizations not only have problems with kind of the initial trust and migration parts of it, but the logistics of actually getting that data gravity center I was talking about moved. It could be really long timelines, like multiple years before they're actually ready to do that. Oh, and wow. So one of the most popular things that's happening right now is bringing public cloud services into their data centers. So you've got Azure Rack, you've got AWS Outpost. These are subsets of their AWS and Amazon or Azure infrastructure that you can bring into your data center and talk to right over your local network using the same APIs that you would use in the public cloud. Wow. And what this does is it gets the functionality next to your data and allows you to learn how you're going to work with it, begin building your processes around how to use it, get some kick-ass latency out of it too, because it's right there in your data centers.
Right,
so yeah, you start checking off some of the big concerns you have, and you're now looking at a pretty interesting migration path that might really change or accelerate some of the ways that you end up ultimately moving to a public cloud provider.
Oh, that's crazy. So
mic drop.
I've heard multi-cloud very little. I've maybe heard that twice, but the hybrid cloud then is obviously, it's hybrid for one, but it's a mixture of the public and the private, right? So how does that interaction happen? And I guess I'm missing a piece of the private cloud model, which is, can private cloud still be like multi-tenant, right? Like as a vendor, I could still have multiple tenants in a private section, right?
Sure. I mean, just look at how organizations use VMware right now. I mean, you might have the sales team running 100 systems on there, and you might have HR running a couple different servers on there, and they all live in the same physical racks, but there is tons of logical isolation that's happening behind them. Virtual machines, and now increasingly containers at this point is the bigger story behind it, because so many things are containerized. But yeah, multi-tenant is a key principle behind it. That's where the sharing of resources comes in that makes it a cloud service. Maybe just to make some folks feel better out there too, I remember working with a defense organization. This was early in my teaching and consulting gig. And I walked into this company, and these guys are well-funded. Okay, budget's not a concern. We can buy whatever we want to buy, that sort of situation. And they're like, we want a cloud. We need you to come in here and show us how to get the cloud working in our data centers.
We want a cloud. You sound like me.
Dude, it was hilarious.
I need a cloud, dude.
Dude, it was awesome. Hook it up, bro. So, So I get in there and I'm like looking at him. I'm like, so you guys have containers, you've got service catalogs, you've got administrative layers, you're using infrastructure as code, you have all of these pieces, and you don't see it as a cloud. And they're like, we need it to be a cloud. We need to work like Amazon's works. And we're like, okay, well, you guys have all the parts. As far as I'm concerned, this is a private cloud that you've built here. And the only thing that's missing ultimately for them was really the user interface and experience part of it. They're cataloging in the way that they were actually leveraging it from we're a business unit, we want to use it. It didn't look and feel like a public cloud provider. And for them, that was the part that was missing. It wasn't that they didn't have all the pieces. They were missing, you know, the one cherry on top that made it accessible and usable for them. And so this kind of goes back to organizations buying stuff, thinking that the silver bullet will cure it, when they don't really know what they need to buy. And then you got these crazy consultants that'll sell them anything that they want to.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah. I mean, the buzzwords are aplenty, especially in that space, especially when you're talking to a dude like me that has no idea what any of them mean. I'm like, yeah, hell yeah, we'll take that hybrid cloud. That sounds resilient as hell to me. You know what I mean? Like multi-cloud, hybrid cloud. Hell yeah, man. Make that thing multi-hybrid as much as you want.
If you're running a private cloud, who are you charging for that metered usage? The business units? Whoever's consuming it? How do you make money?
Yeah. Well, at that point, it's not really about making a profit. It's about being able to pay back. This is where you get into a scenario where you're thinking about chargeback or showback. Chargeback is where the business units are actually paying another division to use the service, so that my budget becomes part of your budget because I'm generating a cash flow to you.
Right.
And, you know, they kind of treat them like separate businesses. That's usually a pretty good pattern there. If there are teams where everybody just shares one giant IT budget, watch out, because at that point, there is no chargeback or showback. The best thing I can do is say, Andy, your team used this much service. And we've attached this abstract value number to it, just to kind of build some sort of a trend around it. But to answer your question, Andy, ultimately what you're talking about is organizations addressing how their CapEx and OpEx models actually work for their businesses and how their financial planning and forecasting is designed to work. Increasingly, a lot of companies work off of grants or allotments, especially once you get into like the nonprofit government organizations, stuff, government. They're not out there to make a buck. And they're living off of allotments that come in, and sometimes they stop. So those are really, really hard. You are going to have a really hard time demonstrating how a flexible cloud service is going to be valuable to them when they want you to tell them what they need to request next month. And you're like, it depends. And you're like, get that depends out of here.
No kidding. The worst thing you could possibly say, right? Like, trust me, I'm smart, but you know, it depends. It depends on what you're talking about. Andy, first of all, that question you got from the Discord was sweet.
I got one more.
That's what I was going to ask you. Yeah. I was going to ask you. I know you got another one, because I have one for Bart too. It's not necessarily cloud related, but it's very similar.
And I have one for Bart later. I'm not even sure I can ask him because it might upset his clients. But this is all right. So let me lead with that one then. So do you have a favorite? Not favorite. Do you have a preferred cloud provider? Like, are you Allegiant to AWS, or can you recommend multiple? Do you have one you prefer, or is that not even something I should ask?
Application specific? Like, what is
No, I'm a huge AWS fan. I'm wearing my Corey Quinn AWS joke shirt today, but I fell in love with AWS early on, and there are a number of things that they do exceedingly well about how their systems are put together. The culture that they have around innovating and growing, the role that they play in the open source community, those are all things that help keep me in the niche. There's a number of reasons why they really outperform some of the other vendors that are out there. I think that in a lot of ways, they don't just have the operating model, but they've created these automated organizational units around each of their product teams and the way that they grow those products. It seems like a super sustainable model. It put them in the lead early on. They have a ton of leverage in the market right now.
Were they first the market? Weren't they like the leaders in building it out?
Well, when you look at infrastructure as a service and what it could be, yeah. I mean, the idea that you could use their virtual network and run virtual machines in it, that EC2 and EC2 Classic, when that came out, that was AWS. That came from them envisioning. New. Yep. And I remember my buddy was like, dude, check this out. You can go on here and run virtual machines and Amazon lets you network with it. And you got routing and switching controls here and they'll give you public IPs. And look, I just ran a WordPress site over here. It just took me this. I did it on my lunch break while I was spilling stuff on my keyboard. And it's like, oh, that's
big advantage. I like that. First to market.
Yeah. Okay. And the other thing, too, is that a lot of big vendors now are getting into hardware. And AWS has made a lot of big hardware investments around processors, and their Graviton processors that they just released recently is a big game changer, because they are going back to some of the same problems that we found out with software defined networking. You don't want to share data in control plane because of XYZ. Same things that happen when you're looking at how to get networking to work for virtual machines on a network card, like SmartNICs that are going to be VMware put a big rollout this year at VMware World about SmartNICs and being able to offload onto circuit boards some of the different functionality that we used to have the CPU handling. A lot of big wins there, power wins, power consumption and compute power wins that come with that. It's all the same patterns for me, though. It's like looking at how Cisco did ASIC-based logic. How Nortel did ASICs versus Cisco throwing it at switching in memory space. Right. Big patterns there. But fast forward now, and you guarantee you Cisco is using EEPROMs and reprogrammable ASICs and programmable field arrays and field gates. Those are all important ways of offloading onto the hardware, because we get it. Hardware line speed is awesome. And if we do it right, it frees up the CPU and memory to do other things that we need, which are also awesome.
That's true.
That's really cool. I'll ask my last question from the Discord server. So this was Chris, our favorite butcher turned IT geek. He wants to know which programming language is the most popular in the cloud, or is that even a thing? Because he's a coder and he's also interested in cloud. So is there a language that he should focus on if he wants to get into cloud?
I'm going to say that based on him coming from this group and asking the question in your Discord channel, I would look at ops sort of world. So I would be looking at Python or PowerShell. And also I would start looking at infrastructure as code, identifying how to get into things like Terraform, some of these high level resource management layers where we can create templates to deploy resources. You're seeing a lot of the same things happen with Nornier and some of the Python automation that's happening there in the networking world.
Yeah.
Very big parallels across the cloud infrastructure. So I find those to be highly transferable skills.
So when you say you're drawing parallels to Nornier and stuff like that. So are you saying that, so I'll just walk you through what's in my head right now. So typically it's very empty.
Get ready.
We're all these cobwebs. when you talk about like interact, like, okay, so using Nornier as an example, like if I'm a coder, just asking like I'm pretending I'm Chris at this point, like, hey, I'm looking to get in the cloud. Like what programming language is important? Because what you're saying is basically that these programming languages like Python, whatever, come out with modules, packages that interface with AWS, right? Or specific things within Azure Cloud, like you mentioned, like S3 or Lambda or whatever. But they basically have built-in functions that that interact with the API, and there's an old, there's like a language, a package, basically a language package that that those two endpoints share. Is that kind of like the gist of that?
Yeah, I mean, they're basically there. You did not need those modules to use those languages to sure. do what a lot of
it's
people
just a lot
doing.
Easier, right?
It's a shortcut. Yeah, yeah. We're talking about encapsulating the functionality and making it so that instead of Andy having to know all of the 200 sub calls that are made, he can focus right. on just passing the right parameters in so that the language interprets it. And frankly, friends, that's exactly what's happening in the world of all of the JavaScript derivatives that happen out there. They're just looking for ways to shortcut and simplify the work that a developer has to have so they can think about the differentiating logic, because that's ultimately what they're there for. It's not all the pushing of the buttons and the levers. It's the direction that it moves in and the functionality that it provides. So when I think about the value that you'll get back from this, developing some skills around using some of those classic automation languages, I still think Bash and shell scripting is an important concept to have as well.
Good to know.
All of these have ways that you can go and interface with cloud service providers to interact with their infrastructure. So I think those are very valuable. The networking world has got their own flavors of this. I've been following John Capobianco. He's one of the guys that I follow on Twitter quite a bit. Mm-hmm. And his recent adventures in network automation have been, I think, just really evangelizing of what there is to win and discover in the world of network automation. Hmm. And if you're doing network automation, you're talking about an extremely transferable skill set in an area that is guaranteed to keep evolving.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Well, that's good to know, too. That's a nice little icing on the cake, I would say. Because that's definitely kind of where you're right, where the collective mindset is of the Discord groups. Clearly, networking. We have people that are, you know, they dabble, or maybe they're more better at automation, and you know, like maybe a little bit more of a specific discipline. But generally speaking, yeah, absolutely. You know, we're talking like your Ansibles and you know things like that. That's kind of like the level of automation.
Yeah, playbooks are a great example of. I called it infrastructure as code earlier. You can think of playbooks as an example of that. In fact, there's a lot of great examples of how you can take playbooks and turn them into something that builds resources in AWS for you, launches servers, configures them for you, terminates them. So the sky's the limit. Once you start thinking API, you're there. That is where all of it is happening across the software development world, network automation world, and the infrastructure worlds as well. They're all talking to APIs. And they're just using their own favorite languages. Opt for PowerShell because it's more comfortable for you, because it works well with other modules that you already know and love, or use Python to do it because you got these other modules you're using, or step out of Python and use Ansible or something like that on top of it to get you even farther away from that underlying code. Yeah. The sky's the limit. And it's up to us to kind of choose which piece of that adventure we want to be a part of. And that's exciting, dang. I think.
Dang. So.
Dang.
I've learned more in the you've taught me more. I'll forget half of it, but that's still a W in my book.
that's why we record this stuff.
So I got a question, dude. Also, first of all, I don't want to stop this without at least mentioning this. We had a Jethro Tull moment at one point. I don't know if you remember that, and it was the only time I've ever interacted with somebody on the internet about Jethro Tull, and I just wanted to call that out because I thought that was super cool.
That's funny, man. I love that funny. Band.
I did too. It's like such a wacky band. But that brings me to the next part. I've seen you do like your live concerts and stuff. Explain the yurt.
Yeah, okay. So when we left Portland, Oregon, this was right after my son was born. My wife and I were looking for a way to basically trying to run an experiment. We wanted to figure out if there was a way that we could go and live rent free. How would that happen? What would that look like? What would we have to do? And we tried it out. So we started looking at low-income houses, low-cost ownership things. And we basically ended up buying some property here in Asheville. Bought it outright. So we own the property, nothing to pay on that, just taxes. And then we moved and we were like, well, yurts are pretty effective for square footage and what you can get. So we built ourselves a 24-foot yurt in the mountains here in Asheville, and we lived in it for a couple of years. as my son, I guess he was probably like 2.5, 3 at that time. So it was just me and my wife and him and too many damn dogs. That's for sure.
So hold on. Explain dogs what a yurt is for everybody just listening. I know what it is.
I was just about to Google it. I have no idea what a yurt is.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You're imagining a circular tent, basically. Yurts are a traditional Mongolian dwelling, so they would have had them instead of teepees. They could collapse the walls and take the roof poles down, put it all on a camel or a horse, and drag it across the steppes out there in Mongolia. And so they would use them in high mountain areas. They'd use them in the deserts. They would use them all over the place. Very versatile. Yep. You could burn fires in them, but they're basically like a
smoke lodge?
Sure, kind of like that. Yeah. It's a cylinder wall, so it's like cylinder walls. It's round, cool. And then you've got a roof that's got little rafter posts that come up off of it, so it looks kind of like a little hut there. And there's all sorts of crazy versions of them. You got to look them up if you're not familiar with it. They're really interesting. And there's a lot of places around the country, particularly out west, where you can go and stay in them at state parks. And it's cool. Life in the round. It's a bizarre space. There's no corners.
Life in the round. Do you feel like you're on like the International Space Station at times?
Only when I'm running around the walls really quickly.
Only when they stop spinning it. You know?
You gotta go really fast to stay on the walls.
All right. So you bought the yurt. You're clearly not in the yurt right now, right? Because I see a corner.
Yeah.
So you lived there for a little bit. Too many damn dogs in there. What happened?
Well, it was also off grid. So when we first moved in, we did not have power or plumbing.
Wow. Which did you do that as a tech guy, first of all?
So at the time, most of the training that I was doing and the consulting that I was doing was remote. So I wasn't like, I didn't need an office per se. I needed to be able to go have office time and an internet connection. Okay. So I was here in Asheville. It's well connected. We had plenty of access. I had some co-working spaces that I used for a while.
Okay.
And I was traveling a good part of the year too. So I would go and I'd fly and I'd go out and teach on site or go meet with clients and things like that. So I just kind of supplemented it with other inputs. But ultimately it proved too much. We had another child. We ended up being able to move to a house nearby on the same mountain and we still live up there. But now we're in the middle of transitioning again. And so this office that I'm in right now is one that I rent here in town and I use it for my recording studio. And the yurt is just up there as a space that we have. And we're probably going to be saying goodbye to it here soon because it's really it's something we've outgrown and we want to get closer to town and we're looking at making some changes. So it's all just an extension of being curious and trying out weird stuff. And I would never be able to get my wife to live in it again at this point. We did that experiment and it was a good learning experience.
What's the thing that you have that is this the yurt where it's, sorry if this is creepy, but there's like stairs or something in there too? Or is that?
Yeah. So I actually built too. Yeah. I built a loft where the bed was to get us up off the floor. So we put the bed up in a loft and I had this cool, like foldable stair ladder thing that folds down out of the ceiling so that you can go climb. I grew up as a carpenter. My dad's a carpenter. So I was able to do a lot of the building on my own inside of it. We bought the yurt as a package, but then I went and customized it pretty extensively and made it work for us. And yeah, it was a project. It was an experiment and we would not live in it again like that. It does not suit our purposes anymore, but we still love them. And I would love to have a yurt again someday. If we move off of this and it's an interesting experiment. I encourage people to go check them out and look at them.
It was a crazy project. Yeah. The off grid thing kind of threw me off a little bit. And also the fact that cause this is what it always looked like to me just from an outsider is like, okay, you got the yurt. It's right next to the house now, right? Like you built the house right next to it.
We ended up buying the house directly next door to it, and I ended up running power and internet down to it. So the recordings that you see of me in the yurt that you might find on YouTube or in some of the CBT Nuggets videos, that was when I actually had the thing legit wired in and hooked up, and that was kind of towards the end of our time with the yurt. So that was that's kind of come and gone now. I'm using this space as a transition between our next efforts, wherever we end up landing next around town.
The yurt makes so much sense to me. Like it makes probably little sense to many people, but it makes sense when it's tied to you for some reason. It's kind of like earlier when I saw the toilet seat guitar and the first thing I thought of was you for some reason. You know, don't take that the wrong way. I know.
What's a toilet seat guitar?
Part of it is the guitar. Oh, you didn't see that? Oh, okay. No. So there's this
Google
meme
carefully, friends.
Joe, be careful. If your wife checks your Google history, you might want to stay away from this. But
so it's a guitar made out of a toilet seat, I'm guessing.
Yeah, it was a toilet seat, was like the head of the guitar, and or not the head, the body.
And, yeah, the body on it.
Yeah, and then there's like a neck coming, and so, we even found a fretless one.
Where do you play, Bart? Because I see like your videos where you got your looper and your... Do you play in that room there that you're in now? Is that where your music happens?
I don't. I haven't played here as much because I have to hump all my gear down here from out of my house. But so I have a workspace at the house that I use above the workshop. So I have a little garage space, and up above there I have a streaming rig that's kind of set up for doing it. It's mostly because of moving out of the yurt, trying to get it to a point where we could sell it off, and then COVID, you know, so it was like, I can't play open mics. I can't gig anymore. I can't play with any of the groups that I wanted to play with around town. So I started doing some online live streaming, and I figured, you know, as a result of this coronavirus mess, I wanted to hopefully have something to show for it. So I've produced a lot of songs and music up there, and it's a good fit. It's been fun. I enjoyed doing the streaming things that you guys might've seen me kind of like switching between stuff. Like I do a lot of live streaming.
Yeah.
Yep.
Use OBS. And so I take those tools with me to an open mic, and it blows people's minds when you'll be in there like, and they're like, oh, this is cool. It's Zoom. And then you start playing like canned video and like doing zoom ins on your guitar, and it adds to
That's
it.
That's rad.
It's a nice,
it's
production.
Pretty fun too.
I've enjoyed your shows. And I guess you're not to call it a hobby, but being a musician, playing music. I mean, we had a mental health episode where we were saying, you know, what do you do for yourself? We work in a stressful industry. Yeah. So I guess music is your outlet, huh?
I am a musician and an artist. I really identify as that. And I consider networking and computers, the tools, they're tools. I really fell in love with tools years ago. Everything that I do is about tools. I love building stuff. I like solving problems with technical tools. I like paintbrushes and artwork. I like mixed media. I like building guitars. That's where that double neck came from. So all of these things.
Whoa,
are...
that thing's wild too, bro. Like, yeah,
wait, you made that?
Goodness.
Yeah.
Dude.
I built it out of existing guitars. Yeah. I mean, I had to cut it apart, joined them together, had to get them all sanded, rewire everything inside of them. But it's super cool. And with the looping that I do, which is where you can record and play back. Andy, you probably know this, but the looping is super cool. And with a double neck, now I have a bass and a guitar, so I can add loops there and then throw some flute on it and then just go crazy. It's really fun.
The Jethro Tull thing makes so much more sense now, because like you had the double neck, you got the cowboy hat going, or you got the, I don't know, is that considered
like
a cowboy
hat? Crocodile Dundee, right? Like
it said it was a cowboy hat when I bought it, but yeah.
Yeah.
It's the coolest hat I've ever seen. I don't know if I can pull it off, but I really like it.
So it's interesting then that your name is Cloud Bart and not Art Bart.
Well, if you look me up online, if you Google Bart Castle, you'll find art by Bart Castle, and you'll find my artwork out there. I do paintings and illustrations, dinosaurs, a lot of music instruments, some oil painting. Some of these pictures that are back here on the wall back here are paintings that I did as well. Those are some oil paintings, and
really
I've got
like
a whole bunch of
mountains
stuff
there.
Yeah, this dude, I don't particularly like coming on here and gassing people up as much as I can, but dude, what the hell is that? Is that a telegraph?
It's a schematic for a piano key hammer.
Whoa.
You drew that?
You freaked out?
Yeah, so I did the background first, and then I went and I found some schematics that I really liked, and I wanted to kind of adapt them.
Wow.
So I took the schematics and projected them up on there, and then added a whole bunch of extra flair to it, too.
That's rad. I love stuff like that.
It's the tool thing. I love the way the mechanics of those things work, and I got a bunch of crazy art you can check out if you want to look at it. But yeah, that's what I love to do, and I love IT, but I also would really love to just play music and make art all day long.
Oh, that's refreshing to hear too. Same. Because I think a lot of the times, like, okay, you in particular, again, I'm not here to just gas you up the whole time, but you in particular, like, look, you, first of all, you have one of the best sort of like, I don't know how to put this, like personas, because of a couple of different things. First of all, your name is one syllable. All right. It's not a very common name.
No.
But it's a very iconic name. And the Cloud Bart thing is it's just easy, right? You know what it is. It's a good brand. Let's just put it that way.
It does work pretty well.
It does, right? So, and I think one of the things is, like, especially for me and the other folks that listen to this podcast, is that, you know, we see folks like you, and even just listening to you, you know, it's like, gosh dang, like, obviously this dude eats, breathes, and sleeps cloud, right? I mean, your name's Cloud Bart, for God's sake. But I always find it very refreshing when there's the human element to it, and especially you saying flat out, dude, I would much rather be doing something else. That, you know what I mean? That means a lot, because this is my hope. My hope is that, like, people hear that when they're getting into stuff like this, because a lot of folks in our Discord are like that. And even me, like, I don't know anything about cloud up until today, like, for the most part. And, you know, I always assume, and this is just kind of where the whole imposter syndrome thing comes from, I think, is that, like, I know you, but you see the figures out there, right? Like yourself, I'm including you in that. And it's like, gosh, man, do I really have to dedicate my whole life? And then I hear not only do you play guitar on live stream, but you built the freaking guitar, for God's sake. Yeah. You know what I mean? That takes time, right? And so that clearly means that you're not spending every waking moment thinking about, you know, what's coming out with the cloud and stuff. And so my hope is that when people hear that, they don't think, gosh, I just have to be completely entrenched in this whole industry as my, like, I go to sleep and I think about it and stuff. Like, it's okay to shut off at 5 o'clock and to think about other things, and to even have a passion that is number one in your life, like even having the kids and stuff, right? Like, dude, you've done a lot of stuff. Like, I'm not trying to overshadow anybody else's accomplishments by any means, but, like, it's a lot of stuff, dude. Like, you know, we've interviewed a lot of people here, and you're doing a lot of stuff, man.
Thanks, dude.
Yeah, well, you know, it's just true. You're just doing a lot, and I the reason why I even wanted to ask about the yurt and the guitar and all that kind of stuff is because I didn't know you're an artist, for one, so that's cool to know, but it makes sense. But I like the human element of it, right? Like, because tech is by nature a very robotic thing, right? Because it's technology, right? It's
totally.
It's you know what I mean? It has no personality. But when you hear that people are, like, especially like you, a creative, because that's a different type of personality completely. Like, a lot of people are analytic, like myself. Yeah. I would consider I'm maybe a little bit more on that side, but being creative and artistic and stuff like that, and being, like, in your case, so far into that spectrum that it's like you're straight up telling us, you got the bumper sticker, I would much rather be playing guitar, right, than whatever the hell I'm doing right this second.
It's so refreshing to hear, because when I talk to somebody like Bart, and he's so knowledgeable, and his knowledge
is
so deep and so wide, that the voice in my head says, well, I got to double down and work harder and study more, because I'm nowhere near that. But just like you said, Bart, I would much rather pursue any of my half a dozen hobbies than do what I do for a living, right? I work to live. I would love to sit down and make some music. I would love to dabble in photography. I just have these things that I really love to do. Time disappears and it really makes me happy. So to hear somebody like you, who is so good at what you do professionally, but then to hear that you have made time for these hobbies, and because it reminds me, like, oh yeah, right. Like, I have a guitar I haven't touched in 5 weeks that I took out and I said I was going to play and I haven't. And I need to be reminded, because in this industry particularly, and maybe because it's where I am in my career, but I feel like I need to study all the time and just, you know, I got to get it all in my head. I would love to teach someday, and we didn't get to that, but I wanted to ask you about teaching, and that's a skill I'd like to develop. And, like, there's just all these things I'd like to do, but they're all competing with work, and I have to know so much. And so it's easy for me to get tunnel vision. So I appreciate you know, pointing out your hobbies and how important they are, and that you identify as a musician first, because
That's huge.
That's nice to hear. I see these people, like, hey, you know, like, you got to do what you love, and, you know, technology's
code from dusk to dawn.
Technology's my passion. I'm like, are you freaking kidding me, dude? Like, okay, I guess, but, like, you know, not me, bro.
I have an iPod. Okay.
I mean, for what it's worth, I really suffered the imposter syndrome too, and I know that a lot of people go through it.
Oh yeah.
It's one of the reasons why I became a trainer, was that it was a direct way to not only validate your skills, but to share them and to engage others. I really, really appreciate that part of it. And it's one of the reasons why I've tried to build a persona. I was not Cloud Bart forever. I mean, that's only a persona that I coined a few years ago as a part of working at CBT Nuggets and becoming a trainer who has a product to offer and is interested. I started with it just as a networking gig to try to find people who wanted to watch training. But I realized that the role that I could play in the community is someone to help keep people motivated and stay excited about a career that will just bury you if you're not, if you let it. And I know so many friends who have that exact experience. Yeah. And I lament it. I don't want to have those experiences. And I really have to balance it though, because I listen to a lot of podcasts and I try to find ways to keep the tech fun and still available and stay up on it. It is hard, folks, and it will burn you out big time. I know a lot of folks who really suffer from it. So find those enjoyments. When people ask me for career advice, I'm always like, well, what do you want to do? No, I don't mean that part. I mean, tell me, what do you want to do? Like, what would you really like to do? Where would you like to live? Mm-hmm. What kind of companies would you like to work for? Mm-hmm. If you can start thinking about those things early on in your career, it'll pay off dividends later on in satisfaction from the career. So I always try to get people thinking about that and not just which search should I pursue next.
Right.
Because there lies madness and it'll just gobble your life up and you'll be 10 years later and you'll be like, oh my gosh, I don't even need that cert anymore. I don't even remember how to spell that technology. And move on to some new target and it never stops. So
it doesn't. No, that's refreshing, dude. Any final last comments? Actually, do this, since you work at CBT Nuggets, leave us with your best little nugget that you have. And I mean, like, if there's one thing that people need to take away from some advice that you could give, you know, anyone listening to this, especially, and I want to target this especially at people that are maybe ignorant to the cloud like myself, or new to it, or want to get into it, what kind of little last bit of wisdom can you leave us with?
Okay. Well, earlier today I made a little, I get asked to do a little PR responses and write-ups for different publications. And they threw me the topic of, do I need a CS degree to get into tech? And I get that question a lot.
Okay.
What I would encourage people to kind of consider here is that if you're looking at investing in your career in some way, whether that be buying a book, whether that be taking a boot camp, whether that be going to a college or an accelerated learning program, really ask yourself, have the objective and the destination in mind before, and make sure that the means that you're going through, they justify that end result there. I don't tell people to just get certified for the heck of it. Now, I like certifications and I kind of weirdly like taking tests. So it's not a bad thing for me, but for a lot of folks, it's incredibly stressful. And you may not get back the thing that you were hoping for from it.
Right.
So if you're looking at organizations that you might work with or partners that you might engage in, look at their ability to help you grow your professional network, because ultimately that is kind of the crossroads that'll get you moving laterally and vertically throughout the industry. Wow. And look at job placement opportunities. If you're going to invest in something, especially like a boot camp or actually going to a college, they should help you be placed somewhere in the industry and not just send you out the door.
Make them earn that money that you're giving them, right?
I feel very strongly in it. And a good example of this is that, for me and my wife, she is about to go into a master's program. I'm very excited for her.
Oh, wow. Congratulations.
But yeah, as far as like the earning dynamic in our household, I have a less than 2-year degree. And I am working in this industry at this point. I don't want to get into a bunch of crazy specifics about it, but the point is how you use it and how you leverage it makes the bigger difference. You don't need a computer science degree to do this. Wow. You really just need to make sure that you're connecting the right dots, growing a network early on, and listening to the people around you for opportunities, because you might be missing chances to move in the right directions that if you don't have the right feelers and you're not actively engaging others or participating in Discord communities like you guys have been chatting about here, you might be missing out on your next great gig. And don't be afraid to think outside the box. So I really try to get people to think about the best way to apply leverage to their career, because in the end, that earning potential or that life flexibility, those things are all hinged around the employers that you work with and the people that you work alongside, and how they can help you move to the next steps. Just like I said, if you see something that's cool, go talk to that person. Find out what they did to get there and strike up that conversation. It'll take you far.
That is definitely a common sentiment in everybody that we've talked to that I feel like has been successful, which is everybody that we've talked to. So that's definitely not unheard. I feel like it's keeps getting reiterated, which I love. But I think the best way to sum up what you just said was something that you said earlier, actually, is that you love tools, right? And the tool is only as good as its function, right? You wouldn't use a screwdriver to do what a hammer should do, but you should be using that screwdriver to the best of its potential. Find every little thing that it can turn and use that screwdriver, right? So it's not necessarily what screwdriver you bought or, you know, how expensive it was or how long it take you to get the screwdriver. Just use the screwdriver to the best of its ability and exhaust it to what get out of it what you gave into it, right? So
that's sure.
Nice little pretty bow on that, I think. But it comes full circle, man. Just like everything else. Just like that yurt.
Life in the round.
Life in the round. That's crazy. We're probably going to name this episode Life in the Round, which I think, or Hybrid Yurt, something like that. We'll get creative with it.
Around in
but
the
club. Dude, thank you so much for coming on here and chatting our ears off.
Yeah, thanks, Mark.
We really appreciate it. You're pretty easy to find, but we're going to put your stuff down there anyway, but it's at cool. Cloud Bart, pretty much everywhere. Bart Castle on YouTube, right?
Or yeah, you can find me. Just give a Google for Bart Castle or Cloud Bart. You can find me on LinkedIn as well. And of course, there at CBT Nuggets. And yep. If you've got questions, please hit me up. I really try to watch my messages and respond as much as I can to people reaching out, even if they're just asking, what should I do? I got this thing. I'm in this place. I love to talk and I like to be accessible. So.
No, you've definitely proven that and a wealth of knowledge for sure, which I hope you've exemplified in the crowd is not going to miss that. I can promise you. So dude, thanks much again for coming on here. I know we've been bouncing all over the place trying to schedule this just because, you know, life happens to our earlier point. Right. And you know what? That's okay. So we appreciate you coming on here and our crowd does too. I always speak for them because that's just what I do. and I just love bringing that up now too. That's part of my shtick.
I've heard great things about the program. So kudos, friends, keep it up. I think that you're offering a really worthy service that's going to motivate a lot of folks now and in the future.
That's kind of what we're hoping, man. And that's why we bring folks like you on here is because, you know, we see that about you and we know that would add fuel to our fire. So again, yeah, we appreciate that from everybody. It's getting hot.
Getting excited, yeah.
So yeah, man, thanks again for everybody, us, Andy and I, and we're find us on the internet, ask the student questions at Cloud Bart, and you can find the rest of us at Art of Network Engineering, at Art of NetEng, and if it's on YouTube, if you're watching the video of this, please like, subscribe, do all that jazz, because you know you want more of this and you want more of Cloud Bart, obviously, because look, the guy has more to talk about, and you can find his channel via us as well, which he has. So thanks again for joining, dude, and everybody out there, we'll see you next week.
Hey everyone, this is AJ. If you like what you heard today, then make sure you subscribe to our podcast on your favorite podcatcher. Smash that bell icon to get notified of all of our future episodes. Also, follow us on Twitter and Instagram. We are at Art of NetEng. That's Art of NetEng. You can also find us on the web at artofnetworkengineering.com, where we post all of our show notes. You can read blog articles from the co-hosts and guests, and also a lot more news and info from the networking world. Thanks for listening.